Now, the Irish Congress of Trades Unions held its All-Ireland executive meeting yesterday, and the implications of Brexit were very much high on the agenda there. Joined on the line to discuss this by Owen Reedy, Assistant General Secretary of ICTU. Owen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciarán. Happy to be here.
We're delighted to have you. There are a number of strands to the implications of Brexit on the island of Ireland, but I suppose the key sticking point at present is the implications of the Northern Ireland Protocol, but also how it may affect trade and the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, definitely. We represent 800,000 workers on the island here through 45 unions and 200,000 workers in Northern Ireland from across the community. And we're particularly concerned because the protocol was an agreement freely entered into by the UK government and the EU to deal with the uniqueness of Northern Ireland being part of the UK and out of the EU, but with a land border with the rest of the Republic of Ireland. And we're very concerned that what we're seeing now is having two parties entered freely into an agreement, you have one party effectively trying to undermine it and walk away from it and rewrite it. And we know ourselves when we do agreements with employers, you know, your word is your bond. You must honour your agreements. Both sides agree otherwise. So it's very concerning. And I think it has the potential to undermine the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, which is the finely balanced constitutional settlement for the last 20-odd years. So we have huge concerns.
Not helped, I would imagine, Owen, by what gives very much the impression of being showboating on this matter to his electoral base by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
Yeah, it seems to us that the strategy of the UK government is to be in constant conflict with the European Union and to point to the European Union as the bogeyman. And unfortunately, he's using the community in Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland citizens, whether they're British, Irish, Northern Irish, or none of the above, he's using them as a pawn. And this is destabilising relations because, as you know, the Good Friday Agreement had three strands, the internal dimension, strand one, the north-south dimension, strand two, and the east-west dimension, strand three, the totality of relations. And, you know, the reality is that the hard Brexit that the UK government forced did lead to a sea border east-west, which we don't want and does have to be addressed. But the solution to that isn't to have a hard border, a land border. And the protocol is to try and address that. Now, the protocol is imperfect. There are issues with it. There are people within unionism that have highlighted issues with it that do need to be addressed. But the way to address it is not megaphone diplomacy and not saying that you're going to walk away from your commitments. The way to address it is through negotiation, good faith, and good diplomacy. And we're not seeing that from the Tory government at all.
And their stance and perhaps predisposition to any form of negotiation will not be helped by a reaffirmation today by EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who says the Brexit protocol on Northern Ireland will not be renegotiated. She's spoken to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on that matter. So it seems neither institution or neither collective are for turning, but who's caught in the middle are the people and workers of Northern Ireland.
Yes, the citizens of Northern Ireland, the consumers, the workers, the businesses, all of the people, they are caught in the middle. But, you know, the solution to this is not a renegotiation of the protocol. The solution to this is, on the one hand, accepting the sad reality, and we say sad because we didn't want Brexit, we campaigned against it, but the sad reality that Brexit has occurred, but also respecting the fact that the EU single market, of which we in the Republic of Ireland are very much a part of, has to be respected. Mm-hmm. And I think there is space within those two realities where the various political parties in Northern Ireland, the trade union movement, the businesses and the community voluntary sector, can come together, work with the EU, work with the UK government, to have an agreement that works for the people of Northern Ireland, that is done with them, not to them. And I think we need to make sure that the political rhetoric that we hear from unionism and nationalism is dialed down, and we look at the practical issues that cut across all of the community and try and address them and deal with them. Because there are unintended consequences of the protocol that do need to be dealt with, but it isn't, you know, the end of the UK. It isn't the constitutional crisis that some say it is. And I think we need to be calm, measured in our language, and negotiate on the issues that are of concern to people, to businesses, to workers, to consumers. I think if we do that with good faith, we can address these issues. But when you have one party to the agreement here constantly seeking to heighten the tension, i.e. the UK government, it's very challenging and very difficult to do so.
And it's also incredibly difficult to see what, in fact, it is the British government want to achieve here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are those in political unionism who are pragmatic in Northern Ireland who just want to see the end of what they consider a border within the UK. And that's a very legitimate aspiration. It's an unintended consequence of Brexit, and I think that needs to be dealt with and addressed. But what we must remember was it was the UK government that negotiated the protocol that did this effectively. And it seems to us they did it as a kind of a fudge, and they said we'll deal with the consequences down the line. Now, that's not good faith. So we do need to square the circle. We don't want to see a border east-west. We don't want to see a border north-south. I mean, we didn't want to see Brexit, but we have to deal with the realities of it. The UK government, it seems to us, their strategy is this kind of, you know, heightened political tensions, see the EU as the bogeyman, have constant conflict with the EU, because that seems to appeal to the kind of English nationalist sentiment.
It's also a very handy distraction from live domestic matters. So on a purely strategic communications basis, if Boris Johnson keeps pointing at the EU bogeyman, woman or indeterminate and saying Brexit, Northern Ireland Protocol, everything is bad, nobody else is looking at what's going on in his domestic political affairs. So it suits him to keep this going.
Exactly, and therein lies the problem. It's incredibly hard for the European Union to negotiate when one hand is tied behind your back by your partner or your opponent, whoever you wish to see it, because it suits them to use, you know, whether it's the importation of chilled meats, sausages or whatever, it suits them to blame the European Union for all their ills. And let's remember, the UK has yet to see the impact of Brexit because we've obviously had the COVID-19 crisis over the last 18 months, the pandemic, and I think it suited Boris Johnson to nearly kind of sweep away the Brexit implications under the COVID-19 blanket. And we know that the UK started off very, very well with its vaccination programme. We've effectively caught up with it now. But, you know, he has gone for broke with this Freedom Day nonsense and the 100% opening, and we're going to see the ramifications of that. Thankfully, the Northern Ireland Executive has taken a more prudent approach, a more steady approach, conscious that we are in an all-island situation and trying to manage the pandemic based on data in Northern Ireland. But it is a worrying time, but I think that's why people in the trade union movement, in the business lobby, farming community and voluntary sector, we all need to step up now and say, you know, this is too important to be left to politicians alone. The social partners and social dialogue has a role to play. We represent people in a different sense and through the trade union movement, because they're workers, members of our organisations. Business lobbies represent businesses through members of their organisations, and we need to try and come together, speak with one voice and stand up for a kind of a rational approach that says, look, Brexit's an unfortunate reality, but how do we make the current situation work for everybody where it's not a threat to their identity, to their politics, but that we make it work for workers and businesses and everyone else alike? And it's a challenge. We need to do it, and we're up for it. And as I say, it's too important to be left to the politicians alone.
Owen Reedy, Assistant General Secretary of ICTU, with particular responsibility for Northern Ireland. Thank you indeed for joining us. Now, the heat wave continues. Everybody's saying it's going to end tomorrow, but it may trickle on. But regardless of whether or not the sun is splitting the stones, we still need to look after our skin. And to that end, I'm joined on the line by Kevin O'Hagan. He's Cancer Prevention Manager at the Irish Cancer Society. Kevin, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much indeed, Ciara.
We're hearing today that skin cancer, the number of skin cancer cases is forecast to treble over the next 20 years. That is a shocking statistic.
Yes, it is, Ciara. And you know, it's really frightening because Ireland now has one of the world's highest skin cancer rates. And as you said, you know, the number has almost doubled over the last 10 years and projected again to double again by 2045. And it's really worrying because, you know, we often spend so much time trying to raise awareness and encourage people to be safe in the sun, and yet, you know, it's quite a challenge now to seeing these figures. And as most during this heat wave, it's an opportunity to remind everyone again the importance of protecting your skin and avoiding getting sunburned, which is the most important risk factor that, you know, that we need to be mindful of, and ensuring that we don't get sunburned. because obviously getting sunburned just once every couple of years can really triple the risk of melanoma skin cancer.
And we're going to hear now a little snippet from Laura Daly. She's the mother of a 15-year-old boy who got so badly sunburned since the beginning of the heat wave that he has second-degree burns.
I think it was because he was in the water. He spent most of the time in the water. He was in the water for over 3 hours. Each time he came out, we reapplied the sun cream. I made a fatal mistake of not actually making him sit and wait 5 or 10 minutes to let it dry in. We only waited like a minute and I said, "You're grand, go on."
And I would imagine, Kevin, you know, Laura could be forgiven for not having allowed the sunscreen to dry on her son before he went back into the water. It's easy done. We've all done it.
Yeah, it's a very simple, a very easy mistake to make, and it's very, very quickly our skin can burn in these conditions, particularly this week. You know, most of the population has very fair skin, which means we'd burn really easily, and we don't tan very well. But yeah, that's an easy mistake to make. You know, sometimes we don't give enough of time for the skin to dry, to apply the sunscreen. Maybe we don't put enough on. You know, we miss little patches on our body. So it's easy to slip up with that. And we know that people don't often put on enough. And it's suggested we almost put on, during these days anyway, as much as the size of a golf ball to cover the entire body. So we need to put it on regularly every couple of hours. And of course, that's one important element of the SunSmart code to protect your skin. I suppose we'd be suggesting to people that really during this week, to avoid that peak time 11 to 3, stay in the shade, which is probably the best form of protection, and not to be exposing your skin really at that hot part of the day.
And take a leaf out of the book of the tens of millions of Spanish people, and if you can take a siesta between 11 and 3, nobody's going to stop you. Another really important thing are hats and shades, Kevin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the hat, obviously, a really important wide-brimmed hat protecting your face, ears and neck. And of course, the sunglasses is really important, guarding your eyes against, you know, the harms of the UV, because we know you can get non-melanoma skin cancers on the eyelid and around the eyes. So UV exposure can certainly damage the cornea, the lens, the retina. So sunglasses is a really important element of the SunSmart code as well. And of course, the hats but clothing as well, Kira, you know, not exposing your skin to that high UV rays, wearing long-sleeve T-shirts, long sleeves, collared T-shirts, clothes made from close woven material, and that, there are clothing there with UV protection as well. So just be mindful of that. So it's just a reminder at this time, we really want people to enjoy the good weather, but we just have to issue this kind of warning because we know that sunburning and tanning does certainly increase the risk of skin cancer.
And why, Kevin, is the ICS telling us that men are at greater risk of developing skin cancer? Is that because of perhaps outdoor work? Is that because they may be less likely to apply sunscreen as generously as possible?
Yeah, Kira, that's all true. Yeah, we know that outdoor workers have an increased risk because they're obviously exposed to about 2 or 3 times more UV than indoor workers, and most of the outdoor workers are working construction and agriculture. And we know that 1 in 4 skin cancer deaths now are actually from that sector, construction, outdoor and farming. So men seem to be at a higher risk, but we know that while more women are actually being diagnosed with skin cancers, the men seem to be leaving it perhaps a little late to get the treatment and seem to have more trouble in the later stages. So more men are actually dying from skin cancers than women. So it is a message for us all, a message certainly for outdoor workers and men to be mindful at this time. And I think the message is really being about being prepared for it. You know, we don't get weather like this too often, and maybe we're not just as prepared as we should be. Having the hat and the glasses and the sun cream available to us and just following that simple SunSmart code.
Well, Kevin O'Hagan, Cancer Prevention Manager at the Irish Cancer Society, thank you indeed for joining us. And one man who is really echoing everything that Kevin has said there is 35-year-old Connor Graham, who he was diagnosed with malignant melanoma earlier this year. He's now appealing to others to take care during the heatwave.
Please don't underestimate the Irish sun. Do take regular breaks inside in the shade when you can, and please reach for that high factor of sun cream. And certainly from my own personal experience, please, if when you're looking at your skin, you know, on a regular basis, because you only have one skin, if there's something that you're really not happy with or something has changed in colour, diameter, size, please get in contact with your GP and push for that appointment, because I think from an early detection point of view, it certainly saved me.
And that was Connor Graham. Now, third level students who were or currently are in receipt of the pandemic unemployment payment will still receive their grants for the forthcoming academic year. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Victor O'Loughlin. He's USI Vice President for the Border, Midlands and West. Victor, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good evening and thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. This has to have been a huge point of worry for third level students who rely on the grant in order to get them through the academic year, and who in many cases for months have been relying on the pandemic unemployment payment. It would have been manifestly unfair if receipt of PUP had drawn, had driven down or perhaps nullified a SUSI grant.
Course, but I suppose to start off on a more positive note, it's a very welcome statement that it's not going to affect the SUSI grant. Even Minister Niall Collins said that students aren't going to miss out on the SUSI grant if they were in receipt of PUP. So it is a great sigh of relief for quite a lot of students who had been receiving PUP. I suppose from our point of view, we didn't want to get in a situation where students or even their parents would have had to have chosen PUP or the SUSI grant, choose between the two, whether it's money now or money later. That isn't what we wanted to see, and we're quite relieved to see that isn't going to be the case. It's been months now without clarity, but now we have the clarity, and I think quite a lot of students will be relieved to hear that.
Because for some students, the receipt of a SUSI grant is the deciding factor as to whether or not they may attend third level. And had this clarity not been given at this juncture, Victor, people may have been considering either not going to third level in the first instance or not returning to complete their course.
Yeah, it's all possible. I know myself, when I was a president of the Students' Union, there was difficult conversations to be had for students who couldn't receive SUSI. It really is the deciding factor for a lot of people attending third level education, because not only do SUSI cover fees for quite a lot of people, they also provide a maintenance grant as well. But it is so important for those students. It makes all the difference. It makes the difference between potentially paying the electricity bill for the week or having something other than pot noodles for dinner. And for other people, it just means a roof over their head or paying towards a roof over their head. But look, since 2011, the SUSI grant hasn't actually increased. It was in fact cut. So we as an organisation are lobbying to see that reimbursed to pre-2011 state.
And I mean, at 2011, that was just before the absolute pit of rent payments. So costs for anybody living out of home for whatever reason since that time have increased almost exponentially. But students, the vast majority of whom are renting either on campus or off campus or in digs, will have seen a massive increase in their living costs in the foregoing 10 years.
100%. I mean, before COVID, I suppose we had two main talking points as a country. We had a huge accommodation crisis stretching across Galway, Cork. We had Dublin, other urban areas across, and of course we had climate change. But for students, that accommodation crisis was terrible for quite a lot of people. And again, it's going back to those difficult conversations, how so many people didn't actually get to go to college because they weren't able to get accommodation. But accommodation costs are soaring, and unfortunately SUSI isn't rising to meet that.
Do you get any sense, Victor, of an inclination at government level to increase it, or do you think that they will feel this is the wrong time in the wrong context to even consider increasing the SUSI grants?
I don't have those details in front of me, unfortunately.
No, I'm just asking for your sense.
I have to follow up with
I don't have those details in front of me. I don't have any inclination, because I am only in the job, I suppose, about 3 weeks, so I haven't had the opportunity yet to open those discussions. But again, I'd be more than happy to follow up with the president of USI and yourself about it.
Great stuff. Well, Victor O'Loughlin, Vice President of the USI for the Border, Midlands and West region, thank you indeed for joining us. Do remember that we're always looking for your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. And if you have an ice cream van and you might want to take a swing around the M7 Business Park, there's an entire radio station here who might want a 99. Now, the Oireachtas Justice Committee has recommended that the Dying with Dignity Bill undergo further scrutiny and assessment by a specially established Oireachtas Committee. I'm joined to discuss this matter by the Chair of the Oireachtas Justice Committee, Kildare North Fianna Fáil TD, James Lawless. James, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara. Good afternoon.
I know that your committee has done quite a significant body of work on the Dying with Dignity Bill, of course, tabled by TD Jean O'Kenny. 1,400 submissions to public consultation. It has undergone assessment by the Parliamentary Legal Office in the Houses of the Oireachtas. What does it mean that you have recommended that a separate and specialist Oireachtas committee be established to look at this bill?
Well, what it means is that we've done as much as we possibly can do or could have done on the bill that was presented to us. The bill drafted by Deputy Jean O'Kenny, and I want to acknowledge his efforts in this regard, and it's a very important issue that he's raised, and I suppose he's challenged us all to have that debate. Mm. The bill that came to our committee, we as a committee, we process legislation that comes to us. We don't have scope to go performing wider inquiries or looking into matters of policy or conducting sort of open-ended examinations. What we did was, when we got this bill referred to us, we said, look, we appreciate, even at the outset, we said this bill may not be robust enough to proceed, but let's take the opportunity to examine the issue. We took, as you mentioned, 1,400 submissions in from the general public and interested parties, and reviewed all of those and categorised them and took findings from them. We also took legal advices, and I suppose we did everything we could do to have the conversation. Ultimately, the bill, we have to, as a legislative committee, we can process legislation that's before us. We can't go drafting our own or making it up if it doesn't exist.
So you can't look at any bill, and I'm not speaking specifically about this bill, but any bill that's on your table and say, look, that could do with a bit of tweaking to make it more robust or to get rid of X, Y or Z problem. You're not empowered to do that.
Well, we could do a bit of tweaking, but we can't do wholesale reworking. So this bill, unfortunately, required the latter. This bill, and I want to be careful in my words because I don't want to be disrespectful to the authors and the effort that's put into it, but it just isn't ready to go to become law. And this literally is a life and death issue. So if you look at, for example, the New Zealand Parliament passed a law on this, ran to over 240 pages. If you look at Westminster, they have tried and actually failed 3 times to do this. They've had various efforts with the Attorney General and everybody else involved. They still haven't quite got it right. It probably was always ambitious for a private member's bill drafted up by an independent deputy that ran to 4 or 5 pages to be the thing that became law to enable assisted dying in Ireland. It was probably always a bit of a stretch that might happen on the first attempt.
Mm.
But I suppose what it has done is it has put the issue into the spotlight. To be honest, from a technical point of view, we probably should have just rejected the bill on technical and legal grounds yesterday. We probably, if we're true to the letter of the law and the rules that we run under, we should have said it stops here, because the bill isn't fit for purpose. The bill isn't drafted in any way that would meet constitutional legal requirements. It would be challenged and I think would fail in a court of law. And no doctor would actually be able to
work under it
because there's confusion. So if we were to be true to it, we actually to the rules, we would have said no, it's not, this is the end of it. We didn't want to do that because we recognised the very serious issues contained and the very genuine concerns held by a lot of people in the public that made submissions on it. So we said, rather than killing it dead, we'll actually put it to a special committee. So our committee, unfortunately, cannot do it. It's just not set up that way. But as with things like the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, as with other big social issues that have come up in the recent years, the Oireachtas has mobilised a committee just for that purpose, just to say, look, we're going to take soundings on a particular issue. It won't have housekeeping, it won't have other legislation, it won't have other business to do. It would only have this as its job, to go and look at this, and it could take 6 months or 9 months or whatever long it takes, and come up with a set of recommendations, and they may well include a kind of model law which the government could then sponsor and move forward with. So we think that's the way it should be done. We think it deserves that kind of assessment. We're not in a position to do it, and according to the rules and how we run ourselves, even if we wanted to, we just couldn't do it. But a special committee could be set up and convened to do just that, and that's what we recommend should happen. So I suppose it's back to the Dáil now, really. In the government, to an extent, of course, the government can legislate for it if they wish, but I think it's actually wider than the government or any one party. It's something for all of us, elected representatives. And we put it back to the Dáil. So the Dáil has a business committee, it has a representative from every party on that, and that business committee, we've asked them to put together the next steps on this.
Because I know the last time Gino Kenny, who tabled this bill, was on Kildare Focus on this matter. He was very open to making whatever technical, legal and drafting changes were required, and also in order to bring the bill into a form in which it could again be put before the members of the House. I would imagine it bears repeating, James, that the problems with the bill are not its spirit or what it intends to achieve. This is a technical legal drafting matter.
Yes. So I was contacted by a number of people, I suppose, over the term of this bill being examined, but particularly in recent days coming to our decision. And they were making various arguments, you know, strong arguments, emotional arguments in some cases, and on both sides of it saying, please don't do this or please do this.
Mm.
And what I said to them all, I said, thank you for your inputs, and they're very valuable, but the decision actually has absolutely no reflection on the merit of the idea. The decision is actually completely irrespective. The decision is that a bill that's been put to us, which runs to 5 pages, could not possibly become law. It just would be unworkable. And for us to try to progress that, even with some amendments, I think would be grossly irresponsible. And I think we would have huge problems down the line in the courts, in the medical, in treatment centres with doctors. To be honest, there's even bits within the bill that contradict themselves, even within the bill before you even vote to any case law. So it's just unworkable. And I think we have to say, look, this is not fit for purpose. We don't have to come out too hard on it because we want to be mindful of the effort that, you know, the good intentions that motivated it. But we need to get something that can do it. Now, I suppose one thing I'd say is that there was an opportunity for the Dáil to actually convene a special committee 8 months ago, because the government did put that to the floor, and I voted for that myself. I thought it was a good idea. Some of the sponsors of this bill at the time said, no, we want it sooner. Can't wait that long. We need to get it done. And really, had they taken that chance then when it was offered, we'd be 8 months into that process now. There was always a degree of inevitability about this, that our committee, when we got the bill as it was, would not be able to progress it. And so that's what's happened. And we're trying to keep it alive, keep moving to the next stage. But there may be an argument put to us in the next couple of days, oh, you tried to stop it. We had to stop it because it wasn't good enough. But really, all of this could have been avoided if the offer that was made back in last November by government to say, look, let's have a special committee now, had that been taken up, we'd actually be into that process and we'd be halfway through it already.
And will that special committee be able to absorb the information that you have gleaned through those 1,400 submissions that were made to your public consultation process? Or would that have to begin again?
No, so that's actually a really important point, Ciara. So normally when submissions are made to an Oireachtas committee and when submissions are made to Parliament, there's a technical legal term called documents of the Houses. And normally they're confined to that one process. We have agreed, and I recommended that committee, that we would waive that for these submissions, and we would ensure that any documentation we have received, any of those submissions from the public and our interested parties, would be made available to any special committee, so we wouldn't have to start again. So we would hand over. My recommendation to the committee, and it was accepted, was any work that we have done, the submissions we received, our own internal reviews, our minutes of meetings, our legal advices, etc., we would actually put that in a box and handed the whole lot of it over to the new committee so that they have the benefit of that. Because I think it's really important that we don't waste that effort and waste that time, because there has been some serious deliberation, and the new committee should have that as an input to their own deliberations.
When is it conceivable that the committee, the new special committee, could begin its work? Obviously, it has to be established, and that will take, I would imagine, it won't be before September, really, that it could conceivably begin.
I would think probably September is likely. I don't know whether the business committee are meeting next week. They maybe have one more meeting before. The Dáil is effectively in recess. Now, we're still meeting committees and that, but the Dáil proper is certainly by the end of this month will be in recess. And the business committee could meet next week and put together this committee. I think probably what's most likely is they will meet in September, kick this off, and we start to see it being put together around then, from that point on.
Well, Kildare North Fianna Fáil TD James Lawless and Chair of the Oireachtas Justice Committee, thank you for joining us. An angst-filled day if you were looking forward to getting married a little bit later this year. No doubt you're still looking forward to it, but what's up in the air is the number of people you may have at your wedding. The number of guests was scheduled to increase to 100 come this August, but Tánaiste Dlí of Radcairn yesterday threw the cat among the pigeons, indicating that that is unlikely to proceed and the current limit of 50 is to be retained. Joined on the line now to discuss this by KFM's own Dara O'Dea of Breakfast Show fame. He is also an award-winning wedding DJ and member of the Irish Wedding DJs Association. Dara, you're welcome.
I was about to say good morning, Kira, and I thought, hang on a second. No, it's the afternoon. That's right. It is the afternoon. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Delighted to do so. This has to be really feel like a history repeating for any wedding vendor, anybody that's involved in weddings. You were looking so forward to being able to get back to more normal style weddings from next month, and that now seems to be on the long finger.
Well, I suppose the critical wording is that weddings of 100 people may not go ahead, but they are still allowing guest numbers of up to 50. So nothing obviously is certain for now, but we are kind of hoping that that situation will change. The important thing that I have kind of seen over the last while is I've spoken to a number of people who have been at weddings over the past few weeks, and they said that even with 50, they've been really, really enjoyable. So that is certainly a positive to take away from it. I know so many people are planning that they wanted 100, they wanted their best friends, they wanted more of their family and friends and all that kind of stuff. But I can say to you in no uncertain terms that weddings with 50 people are still really great fun.
I think because in Ireland we're used to having bigger weddings. Nearly the further you go west, the bigger the weddings are. I mean, I've heard of weddings historically with, you know, 250 and 300 people at it. And that seems like an inordinate number of people. But if that's the kind of wedding that is what's, you know, cultural, what's historic in your family, in your friend group, in your community, 50 must feel minuscule. But it's still a lot of people.
It is still an awful lot of people. And the other thing which most people have to remember is that the days of going to 2, 3, 4 a.m. with weddings is only actually a recent addition. Most people who would have gotten married, let's say, even kind of pre-2000 in the kind of mid to late 1990s, is that most weddings finished around midnight, 12:30 anyway.
So the current 11:30 shutdown point isn't that much of a difference from the historic norm, but it is a difference from the recent norm.
Yes, it is. And the thing to say about the 11:30, yeah, sure, 11:30 will be finished and most people will have to clear out from premises from that particular stage. Obviously, you will have some people who are staying in venues that have a residence bar. Mm. And each particular venue will be policing that the best that they can.
I know that live music is still indoors, something that's on the blacklist, if you will. Speaking to your colleagues in the wedding industry, Dara, how is that impacting the manner and tone and feel of weddings, if at all?
Well, it has to be said that it's been 500 days. And you can go off and count it since March 10th, 2020. So restrictions came into place on March 10th, 2020, which means wedding DJs and the wider entertainment industry have not worked properly. Now, obviously, there is support from government, but there's been little to no interaction between groups such as the Irish Wedding DJ Association as to how we can move weddings to the numbers that couples really want. And whether they're indoors or whether they're small weddings of 25 to 50 people, it would be so nice if government could come to people like the Irish Wedding DJ Association or even talk to people like Tara Fay. Tara Fay is head of the Irish Wedding Association, and she said obviously this is hugely disappointing for couples. The wedding industry as a whole, it's got a great contact tracing system, because for a start, every wedding venue has got a table plan. A lot of the age profile of wedding couples and guests have been fully vaccinated, and none of that has been taken into consideration. So the communication between government and the wider Irish wedding industry is either non-existent or being very, very small.
I would imagine the seemingly off-the-cuff way in which Leo Varadkar made those wedding comments yesterday, Dara, won't have helped either.
No, not at all. The one thing that wedding couples really, really want to get is certainty. They want to know that there's a chance for the bride to wear her dress, to have the number of bridesmaids that she wants, for the groom to wear what particular suit that he has. And everything requires a plan. Planning a wedding is not something that you can do in the space of a couple of weeks. And one of the great things, and one of the great things about Kildare, is that we have some absolutely premier wedding venues. Places like Clanard Court in Athy, Barbastown Castle, K Club, Moy Valley. They're all fantastic wedding venues. Hmm. And these guys will work with couples to make sure that your wedding is a success. But not having the certainty from government kind of brings it to a little bit of a stop. And we don't know where we're going to go from here. But these venues in Kildare and the wider country as well, they will work with couples to get it right on the day as current restrictions apply.
Well, KFM's own Dara O'D, presenter, of course, of our breakfast show and an award-winning wedding DJ and member of the Irish Wedding DJ Association. Thank you indeed for joining us.